Okay, more people are coming on now, but I'm going to start. Today we're going to finish with Rav Avadya Yosef's early years, and then we're going to move on to another great figure who we're going to spend a number of weeks on, and that's Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky. Here's his picture, but we still have to finish with Rav Avadya. And before we get to that, just a few more comments. I'm still responding to many that have written to me. One more thing about this book, Mesorat Moshe, from Rav Moshe Feinstein. I could spend months going through this book if you haven't seen it. It is 620 pages, and almost everything in it is of great interest. But I'll just tell you one more thing, since I mentioned last week about the, becoming the thing that I spoke about, becoming Rabbi of the Hillel. There was one other passage I wanted to mention. I'm not sure why I wanted to mention it, because there's literally every page this stuff, but I think you'll find this interesting, and it relates to things we've seen in the past. Rav Moshe was asked, is there a reason, or an inyan, to speak rabbinically, to teach non-Jews the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, which, Chabad has a plan to teach people the Noachide laws, and you might want to say, well, why not? Isn't that a nice thing to teach them? And Rav Moshe was very strong on this. He says, Behechlet, don't do that. In the Golos, where we are now, it's forbidden for us, Lahotzi Tanot Aladat Shalahem, to say anything negative about the dominant religion. So what would be negative? Well, obviously it's negative, because if you're teaching the Noahide laws, then you have to tell people that you can't worship Jesus, because that goes against one of the Noahide laws. Presumably, it might not. It depends. We spoke about the idea of Shituf, that non-Jews are permitted to worship God together with another being, as long as it's one. But nevertheless, according to many, it would be forbidden, and there's other things that could be forbidden. And Rav Moshe said that that's not our job. Our job is not to tell them how to live their lives. We have no obligation, he says. Uladina in lanu shum hitchayvut. We have no obligation of tochacha, of rebuking non-Jews, if they want to be Catholics or Protestants or no religion or anything. Not only do we have no obligation, he says, this is not something you should do. I didn't know about this tshuva. I wish I did know about it, because in Scranton, there's a Chabad guy. He doesn't live in Scranton, but one of the Chabad missionaries, I guess, to the non-Jews contacted me, and he wanted to come speak at the university, that I should arrange it, that he would speak about the Noahide laws. And I said, I can't do it. And I basically said to him that I can't let you get up at a Catholic university under the auspices of the Judaic Studies Institute and tell them that, their worshiping of Jesus is wrong and that they should observe the Noahide laws, etc., etc. That'll just make my position untenable, create a Chil Hashem. You know, it's not our job to tell them what religion they should and shouldn't worship, just like we don't want them to tell us what religion they should and shouldn't worship. And then he goes on to say that that's the job of the Messiah. And and he says, then he ends, it says, Ramosha said, all the religions will remain until the Messiah, even the hippies. So I guess this is maybe from the 60s he's speaking. And then later on, he's asked, well, will the Messiah be under the controlling, will the Messiah control the non-Jews also? And he says, it's not so simple. So I thought you'd find that interesting. Two more things I want to share, and then we'll start. In the last class, we spoke about Rabbi Yochanan Spector and the Shlita dispute in London, which we're going to get back to when we deal with Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, the whole issue of Nikor and eating meat, hindquarter meat. For those who are new, let me repeat, there's nowhere in America or Canada, as far as I'm certainly nowhere in America under the regular hashgachas, I guess in Canada also, that you can get nikor, hindquarter meat. So we're going to get back to that soon, because Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky had to deal with the same problem we spoke about. But in the discussion, we saw how, when we dealt with Rabbi Yochanan, we saw how the Rogatchover referred to him. He called him the Zakein, the old man. And I said to you that this is it's a little shocking to refer to Rabbi Yochanan Spector this way. Subsequently, I read the autobiography of the Aderis, the father-in-law of Rav Kook, Elio David Rabinowitz Teomim, which is it's sort of like the Rav Yaakov Emden's autobiography, in that he reveals all sorts of things. You know it must be controversial because Mossad Harav Kook has never reprinted it, and a new edition of it came out a few years ago in which they took out all sorts of things. And one of the things they took out are the attacks of the Aderis against Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. And he even refers to him the exact same way that the Rogatcher referred to him. He calls him the Zakein. Just the Zakein, the old man. You know, both the Aderet and the Rogatchover didn't have much tolerance or patience for people who opposed them. So I just bring that to your attention. And finally, one more thing or two more things. Someone emailed me that in the talks on when I dealt with Vilna, I said that they didn't do Mitzitza. The Moalim didn't do Mitzitza in Vilna. If I said that, I misspoke. What I meant, of course, is that they didn't do Mitzitza B'peh. And there's even more than that, I can tell you. They didn't even do it with a tube. The Moalim in Vilna did it with a sponge. I don't know if there's anyone in the world today who does Mitzitza with a sponge. They all do it with that, they call it a pipette, I think. Okay, I have another thing from Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, but I'll save that for next class. For those who just joined us recently, we had a number of classes, I think five classes on Rav Meir Simcha. But let's continue and finish up with Rav Avadya Yosef. Where I left off was the problems he's dealing with in, with the community, the chief rabbi, and the most difficult problem was the Jewish hospital. At this time, in the 1940s, there were 450,000 Jews in Cairo. So it makes sense that there was a Jewish hospital. In fact, the hospital had been around since 1907. It might be hard to imagine, but the meat served in the Jewish hospital was not kosher. I'm not saying that it wasn't God or anything. I'm saying it was not kosher. And the explanation given was that non-kosher meat was cheaper, and they couldn't afford to buy kosher meat. It was already in great debt. Now, when Rav Avadya comes to Cairo and he discovers this, he's in great shock, because most Jews, maybe even the overwhelming majority, only ate kosher meat. So how could you have a hospital that has treif? Furthermore, the patients in the hospital had no idea that they were eating treif. The hospital didn't reveal it to them. Rav Avadya claimed that the chief rabbi also ate at the hospital. Now, I don't think he means, I'm assuming he doesn't mean that the chief rabbi ate meat at the hospital. The chief rabbi was not the greatest Talmud Chacham, but I don't think he was so such a chief rabbi that he would eat non-kosher meat. But he definitely ate at the hospital, even though it wasn't kosher. I'm not sure what he ate. Rav Avadya finds out about this, and he tries to fix the situation. For 6 months, he works quietly behind the scenes to fix it. He does not, this also might be shocking, he does not make any public statements. He feels that the only way he can fix this is by working privately, trying to get it to be fixed. And the biography of his grandson makes this clear, that he did not make a public issue of it. People continue to eat non-kosher. All he did were tell his students and other people he thought would listen to him that the meat was not kosher, but he did not make any public scene, thinking that he could accomplish more working quietly. Yet try as he might, and this included speaking strongly to the community leaders, the chief rabbi had no interest in helping him, the most he was able to get the community leaders to agree to was to open a small kosher kitchen in the hospital, which would be for only those people who requested it. And they could only do this, they said, if everyone on the board would approve it. And this approval process would take months. Rav Avadya saw that nothing was going to happen in this matter, and he had already said that if the matter wasn't fixed, he would resign his position. So he announces, he sends word out to everyone, a big public announcement, that the Av Beit Din, Rav Avadya Yosef, is going to be giving a drasha, a special sermon at one of the shuls. And a lot of people showed up for this, and it was then that he announced that it was forbidden for anyone to eat at the hospital because they serve non-kosher food. And he said that if this is not fixed, he will resign. And he expected them to cave after he made this big public announcement, because he was brought in specially to do the marriages and divorces. There's no one else to do that. The government was forbid the Jewish community from bringing in any other foreign rabbis, and the local rabbis were not up to the task. Yet the community leadership called his bluff and said, "You can resign." And they were happy to get rid of him, as he was causing too much trouble. Now, he tells the story in the volume Yabia Omer, volume 9, number 27. He doesn't actually mention him. He says, Reuven went to Egypt, and he gives the whole story. And then he deals with Shimon, who I'll speak about now, and he's the Reuven. Why he doesn't mention his name, I don't know. But it's all third person. The problem he deals with is not the kashrus problem. It's the status of this rabbi, who was really just a preacher. And when Rav Avadya resigns, he expected all the rabbis who were there, people serving as rabbis, to follow him, basically, and not to cross him. And this one, who he says is basically only a preacher, he is appointed in Rav Avadya's place. So Rav Avadya, as you can imagine, is very upset about this, and that's what the responsum is about. How you're supposed to relate to this person, he begins the responsum. The answer is saying this Shimon, he doesn't give his full name, sinned grievously from that, and he should be put in cherem for accepting the position that he wasn't worthy of, especially after the chief rabbi, the Av Beis Din, has resigned. So that's the tshuva, the responsum he deals with. Another problem, and by the way, he never again was Av Beis Din. We'll see that this leads to him leaving Egypt. Even before that, there was another problem. There was only one mohel in all of Cairo. 45,000 people. There was only one mohel approved by the government. And since he had on Shabbos, there was brises, britot, all over the city, he would drive a car. He would drive a car to go to the bris. He was not a complete mechal Shabbos, Rav Avadya tells us, because he thought this was permissible. To drive a car, basically, to get to where you need to go. And you could perhaps bring a source that, you know, certain things the rabbis permitted on Shabbos for the sake of a bris. Rav Avadya said, since he was a shogeg, you could still use him as a mohel. Because it was very hard, Rav Avadya says, and people will not listen if you told them to bring in a mohel from Alexandria. There was a mohel from Alexandria. That's the one Rav Avadya Yosef used, and that's the one that his students used. However, the masses, you couldn't ask him to bring in a mohel all the way from Alexandria, put him up for Shabbos, he'd have to stay there. And Rav Avadya was able to convince the mohel not to drive the car himself, just to, take taxis, or be driven around by non-Jews. And under the circumstances, Rav Avadya felt that was all, you know, that's enough. That's enough to get the mohel. As long as the mohel isn't driving himself, it's okay for people to use him. And this is discussed also in Yabia Omer, Volume 10. That's the last volume of Tshuvot, published by Rabbi Avadya Yosef. Hopefully a new volume will appear. Volume 10, Yoredeya 25. So Rav Avadya resigns in 1949, or his resignation is accepted. He remains in Cairo for a time, giving shiurim to his followers, and these included some important people who tried to get the community to hire him back, to no avail. They were actually willing to rehire him if he gave up his demand that the food be kosher, but he refused to do that. In fact, what's interesting is after Rav Avadya had already resigned, only then, due to community pressure, that is, other people in the community, they made the hospital entirely kosher. But they didn't rehire Rav Avadya. Him, they were happy to see go. So in a sense, Rav Avadya, he sacrificed his Parnassa in order for the hospital to be kosher. They were not prepared to give him the same authority. The most the community was prepared to do is to keep him on as some sort of small rabbi. They were not going to make him Av Beis Din anymore. The president of the community, and in the biography, the hagiography of his grandson, you see a picture of this man, you know, he wears the fez, that's the way they dressed. He was particularly angry at Avadya, and he actually used the psak we talked about last week. The psak that the dayanim had to look in and see the woman going into the mikveh when the woman converted. He used that against Rav Avadya to show that Rav Avadya was some sort of pervert. That, you know, he would require the dayanim to look at the woman when she was tovel. We spoke about how they look in a completely modest way. She's already, they could just see her head go down. But the president of the community, to make Rav Avadya look bad, used that decision of his. And there were other problematic things in Cairo. We won't go into it now. for example, the Jewish schools, scheduled exams, written examinations on Shabbos and Yom Tov. You know, we're dealing with a population here that I'm not going to say assimilated in the sense that they were intermarrying. You didn't have that so much in France. You had some Christians, and there was a problem with, but Jews are not marrying Muslims. But they were very acculturated. They were very French-oriented. And many of them really were not traditional at all. They also, this is interesting, Rav Avadia was very upset about this, they included Karaites on the school board. Karaites went to the Jewish school, and Karaites were on the board. Now, Rav Avadia actually has a liberal position about Karaites. He has a long response in later years that you can convert a Karaite, and he himself converted Karaites. This goes against the Ashkenazic approach that the Karaites have yichus problems, mamzerus, but Rav Avadia would convert them. On Erev Shabbos, 1950, Rav Avadia Yosef returns to Israel. He will return again to Egypt one more time, as far as I know, just once more, invited by Mubarak. There was an issue with the hospital, with the cemetery, when they wanted to build a road through it, and the community, the small community, was protesting, and Mubarak asked Rav Avadia to come, and Rav Avadia found a solution that the road can go over the hospital. But other than that, he did not return. He was only there a few years, but if you look at his writings, there are many responses of the date from that period. He developed many of his ideas that period, and he also learned how to live with a community full of non-religious people, both which contained non-religious, I guess we'd say, people who were inimical to his type of orthodoxy and gave him many problems, and also people who were very sympathetic and basically were what we'd call the non-observant Orthodox, that is, people who respected him, just were not observant. And you see, as I mentioned already, that through his writings, a great tendency to judge well and to lean over backwards, to try to make things easy for those type of Jews, that is, the Jews who are not so pious in actions, but are very pious in feeling, as well as we said, how to deal with the irreligious elements who are, I guess you'd say, even anti-religious. One more thing I mentioned at the very first class, Rav Avadia's love of Arabic music, and I've shown this in the past, but since we have some new people, he was a great lover of the music of Kulthum. I even played it for the class previously. You can go to YouTube. I don't need to do it now. You can hear some of her music. This is what she looked like in her prime. This relates to Rav Avadia Yosef's position about listening to women sing, if you know what they look like. He clearly did, and I spoke about how in one of his responses it says you shouldn't, but then I spoke about what his son told me, and he himself in a later response and changes that and says that there's no problem hearing a woman sing on the radio or anything like that, even if you know what she looks like. And this is Kulthum, who is considered the greatest female singer, Arab singer in the 20th century. Maybe that makes her the greatest singer of all time, because I don't know if we know of female singers before that. Then Rav Avadia, as I said, was a great fan of hers. He picked up his love of this music when he was in Egypt. So we're going to stop now with Rav Avadia Yosef, and I'm going to move on to the next figure, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky. But I will, if there's just any questions, quickly, I will take a question on any questions on Rav Avadia. I can do that at the end as well, but I just wanted to fill this in now so we now know the early years and the later years. Okay, well, let me continue. And at the end of the class, so we could take questions. We're now going to spend a few weeks, at least 3 or 4 weeks, on a very great rabbi, significant figure. I don't know how many of us listening, how many of you listening know anything about him. His name is Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky. If any of you come from England, you definitely know about him. And he has a lot to say, and his story is very interesting, because it'll take us back to Lithuania, to Russia, to life under the communists. Some things we've seen already, other things we haven't seen. So without any further ado, let's talk about Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, who's really a gadol in our times. He dies in 1975, 76, something like that. He's born in 1886 in a small town, Grodno district, Lithuania. His father is just a regular guy, not one of these gadolim or anything like that. And with Rabbi Yecheskel, we have the typical stories we almost always have these stories. Genius says he's young. I will tell you, though, that something we hear about him that's unusual, that we don't usually hear about these figures, is that when he was young, 8 or 9 years old, we're told that he knew a lot of Tanakh by heart. And I'll show you perhaps later, he always had a great Hebrew style, Melitza. Typical Ashkenazic approach is not to really learn Tanakh. And you pick it up later. And the only Tanakh many people know is Torah and what appears in the Haftarah. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky knew Tanakh very well, and you could see it. And this goes back to his youth. It's very interesting because who studied Tanakh intensively in the early part of the 20th century, late part of the 19th century? It wasn't really on the curriculum. He studies in his city until he's 17, which is older than you would think, but then he goes to the Navardic Yeshiva. The yeshiva we've spoken so much about, the yeshiva of, which is really the yeshiva of Shiflus Adam, to try to not raise up man, but to lower him, and that's how you're going to reach God, by knowing that you're nothing. The yeshiva in which they dressed differently, they had beards. It was just a very different type of place. Chaim Grada, as I mentioned so many times, immortalized in the Vardic yeshiva. So how does Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky get to the Vardic yeshiva? If you recall the classes on the Stipler, it's the very same thing. Rav Yosef Yoizel Horovitz, who himself was a bit, I think you might say, eccentric in some of his ideas. The Sri Deish speaks about him once. He doesn't mention him by name, but he talks about how distortions of Rav Salanter's ideas, but he doesn't want to criticize it. He just says that they're distortions. But Rav Yosef Yoizel Horovitz sent out student colleagues. They had all these branches of the Navardic Yeshiva, but they sent out student colleagues as well to recruit Talmidim. And that's how Rav Yecheskel was recruited. Someone came to the city, and he was influenced, and he came. Rabbi Yecheskel was never really influenced that extensively by Rabbi Yoizel. He was influenced, but he didn't become a prototypical Navardiker. He was there less than a year, and he didn't even daven in the yeshiva. He davened in a shul in the city. And while there in Navardik, he got to know the Rav of Navardik, the great Aruch HaShulchan. From Navardik, he goes to Telz. Telz! That's one of the great yeshivas. The Rosh Yeshiva is Rabbi Eliezer Gordon. And there's a whole dynasty here. It goes down to this day. Unfortunately, Telz is not doing so well anymore because the yeshivas have become dynasties. And sometimes the sons-in-law, they're not really up to the level. And then the students go somewhere else. In general, if you're following the news out of Israel, the Lithuanian world is becoming very Hasidic. It's really very dynastic. And with all the problems this brings and the disputes that are going on, it's almost like the early Hasidic movement. The early Hasidic movement, there were terrible disputes in which they said things just like is being said today. And it wasn't only, today in the Hasidic world, everyone knows that it's all about money, power, and status. Everyone knows that the dispute between the two Satmar Rebbes, between the other groups, it's all about power. There's no idealism there. And no one, ask any Satmar, they'll tell you it has nothing to do with it. It has to do with who's going to control it. But originally, these disputes, be it Sanz and Sadagura, or any of the numerous disputes against Breslov, etc., there was idealism there. There were ideas. In the, I think, you might correct me, tell me I'm wrong, but I think that what's going on in Israel now, I think it's about ideas. I don't think it's about power, or I don't think it's exclusively about power. For those who don't follow the news out of Israel, the Haredi news, you have right now a dispute which I have never seen in my life, and I do not know of such a dispute in the Litvisha world. In my next Svarim blog post, I'm going to show you that the language used, you saw similar things against Rav Gorin, but that wasn't the Lithuanian world. You have Lithuanian Rabbanim. Let me be blunt, and I'm going to write this in the Svarim blog post. I think Rabbi Chaim Kanevsky, who's one of the greatest Torah scholars there is, his rhetoric, his language is verging on incitement to murder. And let me explain what I mean. In his circles, what he says, Das Torah, you're going to have people who, listen whatever he says. So we can't be surprised, therefore, if someone goes out and commits a terrorist attack or even kills someone. By the same token, because if they hear him say that Rav Shmuel Auerbach and his followers are Chayef Skila, are deserving of death, And they hear him say, which he did say, that we have him on tape saying this, that you can hear it on the internet, that the people who vote for Eitz, that's the party, how they're referred to, they should be tola al ha'Eitz. They should be hung on a tree. And I'm not even talking about kicking him out of the kollel and saying their pasul is aiding. I'm saying, even if it's not to be taken seriously, and I don't for a minute believe that he means this seriously, but even to make a comment like that, can we be surprised then if one of these crazies goes out and actually does something? Didn't we see that with Yitzhak Rabin? These rabbis were calling him Rodef. Yes, they were not giving a psak, halachic question, that he has a halachic status of a Rodef and you should go kill him. But they called him Rodef over and over again until someone decided, okay, well, if he's a Rodef, I'll take care of him. New square? The Rebbe attack and his people attack over and over again someone in the community, calling him a Rasha because he doesn't accept the authority of the Rebbe. So are we therefore surprised when some man, a shamus, a gabbai, butler to the Rebbe, decides one night he's going to light the whole house on fire and burn it down and murder the entire family? Of course these are crazy people, unbalanced people, but these communities have a lot of those people. So when you use language and you say that someone is chai of skila, and we know what happened the other direction, someone on Rav Shmuel Auerbach's side, even though Rav Shmuel Auerbach has never, you know, it's funny because his views are so extreme that I'm much more in sympathy with the views of Rabbi Steinman, but to his credit, Rabbi Auerbach has never responded to these attacks. He's never said anything, but yet one of his followers, also a bit deranged, was so upset by the way his side is being attacked, he almost killed Rabbi Leib Steinman. He actually went in apparently trying to kill him. So, I mean, when have we ever had things like this? In general, in the Haredi world in the last 10 years, we're seeing all sorts of stuff we've never seen. I mean, have we forgotten so soon? Well, obviously, you have the never-ending financial and sexual abuse scandals, the fights in Israel, the stabbing in Ponevej, the killing of little Leib Kletsky and chopping his body up. I mean, we're seeing things that no one could ever imagine years ago. But in the Lithuanian world today, to have a great rabbi, not just one, saying that if you support another gadol, you're being thrown out of the kollel and you know you're pusilled and everything like that. This is the declaration of a papacy. And since when in Judaism do we have a papacy where someone like Rabbi Yefanievsky can declare that you're obligated to follow Rabbi Steinman without question? If Rabbi Auerbach wants to follow his own position, why can't he do that? He's a great Talmud Chacham. He's enough of a Talmud Chacham. The real question, however, isn't. They're all claiming that they're the inheritors, the Mamshich Darko of Rav Shach. And Rabbi Auerbach saying that, that Rabbi Steinman is really not the Mamshich Darko. The real question, which I saw someone raise, is why doesn't someone ask Rav Shmuel Auerbach, why are you so quick to want to be seen as the inheritor and the Mamshich Derech of Rav Shach? How about being the Mamshich Derech of your father? But that apparently he's not interested in being. In any event, let's get back. I want to get back to what we're talking about. I'm not even sure what led on to that tangent, but the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells was Reb Lazer Gordon. I mentioned the dynasties, the dynastic. He's actually, if you go to London, you can go to his grave. He's one of the few Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, maybe the only one, who's not buried in Lithuania. He was on a fundraising trip to England in 1910, and that there he died there and was buried there, and he was never moved. So Rabbi Yecheskel comes to Tells in 1904, and he's there for 2.5 years. And those were very interesting times, to put it mildly. Very interesting times in a general sense, and very interesting times for Jews. Now, there's a biography. It's actually not a biography. It's a hagiography of Yecheskel Abramsky. It's called this Melech Yofio. It's by Aaron Sorosky, who writes all the Haredi biographies. And it's good. It's actually one of his best ones. It's full of good information, and I use it extensively. Of course, it has Haredi tendencies, as they always do. To his credit, though, in this book, Rav Cook is referred to as a Gaon, Rav Unterman. Unfortunately, Rav Soloveitchik is not. I even mentioned in my Saul Lieberman booklet, I refer to this book because if you know Haredi code, you can see it clearly. In one passage, he talks about the Gaon Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal and the Gaon Rav Yitzhak Kuttner Zatzal and Harav Yosef Soloveitchik Zal. So in Haredi code, what that is saying is that Rav Soloveitchik's not a Gadol. Well, he's not called Gaon, and he's not called Zatzal. He's only called Zayin Lamed and Harav. But basically, it shows respect even for the ones who are not in the Haredi camp, because they sort of has to, because Rabbi Abramsky showed a great deal of respect for them. In any event, all he says about this period of significance to what I'm going to talk about now, that is Rabbi Chesko Abramsky's period entails, is that Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman, later becomes well known as the Rosh Yeshiva Ponevezh, who was also at this yeshiva during this time, he said about that even during the dispute over Musar entails, that I'll speak about now, that Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky is the only student who didn't take his eyes out of the Gemara. And that is, he didn't involve himself in the dispute at all. That's also Rosky tells us. He doesn't tell us what Musar dispute they're talking about. He doesn't give us any details. All he does is quote Rabbi Kahaneman as saying that during this dispute, he didn't take his eyes out of the Gemara. Okay, so what dispute? What's going on here? I mean, if you read this, you're going to think that there is some little dispute in Tells. That is a little dispute between some students, and Rabbi Yecheskel stayed in his corner and minded his own business. However, this was not a little dispute. This was a huge dispute. Things happened in Tells that did not happen in any other yeshiva, and I will tell you about them now. I'm going to summarize it for you. I'll summarize it, but anyone who wants further details, you are invited to see this wonderful book. Shaul Stamfer, Lithuanian Yeshivas of the 19th Century. Big, thick book. Most of it is about Volozhin, two-thirds, and then you have about Slobodka and Tells. Now, it appeared in the Hebrew edition, but this is better than the Hebrew edition because this has even more material. There's two Hebrew editions. Edition number one, then edition number two was very significant. It was expanded, and it was significant especially because now we know why the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed. We spoke about that in previous classes. It wasn't because of a forcing of secular studies. It was because, and that the Yeshiva didn't agree to go along with it. It was because of revolutionary tendencies in the Yeshiva, and the government wanted to shut it down. That's why it was shut down, and we have the Russian documents, and they appear in Hebrew translation in the Hebrew edition. But the English edition is even more expanded, and it's from Lippmann Library, the great Shaul Stamfer. He published two books. This came out in 2012, two books. One was a collection of his essays on different aspects of Lithuanian culture, Torah culture, and general culture. And then this is his masterpiece, his doctoral dissertation, written under Yaakov Katz. But let me give you the highlights from Stamfer. I mean, growing up and reading these things before Stamfer's book, I had certain ideas, I'd read certain things, but Stamfer has all the details and tells a wonderful story. There were two disputes, actually, in Tells. Soroski only mentions Musser. There was really two. One was over Musser, and one was over faculty appointments. The dispute over Musser, the first dispute was in 1885. Rav Eliezer, yeshiva wasn't that old, Rav Eliezer Gordon's son-in-law, Rav Yosef Leib Bloch, who's a legendary figure as well, he was a big supporter of Musser, but not his father-in-law, not Rav Blazer. Okay, let me stop for a minute. Is it choppy? They are having such trouble this semester. Let me stop for a minute. Please text in anyone else and text support. Is it choppy? Incidentally, the actual tapes that have gone out have been perfect and will be perfect as well. So if there's ever a problem, the tapes are clear. Okay, so it's thank you, Bill. Getting back to the Musser dispute, the students were also opposed to Musser, big opposition. The compromise that, see, what was going on? You had the son-in-law and certain factions saying that the students should learn Musser. And when I say learn Musser, I mean obligatory. I'm not talking about like everyone on their own does it. There's going to be a Seder. that where the Gemara is closed and you take out a Musar book and you must study Musar and you can't absent yourself from the Beit Midrash or anything like that, you have to be there. The compromise they arrived at was that not all the Shiurim, that is, not all the levels, there were different Shiurim, you were in different Shiurim, not all the groups would have to study Musar, and it would not be obligatory. Well, if you say it's not going to be obligatory, basically you're saying there's not going to be Musar. Because, why are people going to do Musar? These are not students who appreciated Musar. These are students who didn't want to do it. So if you tell them they don't have to, they're not going to. Meir Bar Ilan learned in Tells, and in his autobiography, he tells that by 1894, there had been a change, and it was now obligatory to learn Musar for one half an hour a night. Not so big, not so terrible. I don't know how much you can accomplish in a half hour, but that's what he claims. The dispute, the second stage of the dispute, begins in 1897, when Rabbi Bloch convinces his father-in-law, Rabbi Lazer Gordon, and Rabbi Shimon Shkup. Rabbi Shimon Shkup was now at Tells. He had come to Tells in the teaching there. Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch convinces them to appoint a mashkiach. Mashkiach is this new position, one who supervises the souls. And the mashkiach's job would be to deliver what we call Musar Shmuzin. Those who went to YU would remember the great, the mashkiach there, Rav Yaakov HaKohen Lesson. He was there for many years, a Sabbatka man. He was followed by Rav Yosef Blau, who only recently retired, or I don't know if he's actually officially retired, and he had a certain assistance, and now they have a new mashgiach, Rabbi Weinberger, Moshe Weinberger, who's a YU man, but really took a Hasidic turn, and he's also a Rav Kook man. He published a translation and commentary on Orot HaTshuva of Rav Kook. But I saw that he's doing something very different, very un-Litvish. I forgot what it was. They just advertised YU. Maybe it's a Farnbrengen or something like that. But the fact that they picked a Hasidic personality, a spiritual type of personality, instead of a Musar personality to be the Mashgiach of YU, I'd be very curious to know how that came about, what they were looking for, why he's very dynamic. But he's hardly a traditional Lithuanian Musar personality, which is what YU, as a Lithuanian place, has always had. But we do know that there are students who are interested in the Hasidut and other things. Rabbi Reichman of YU has brought in various Hasidic leaders, etc. So they want to bring in Rabbi Aryeh Leib Kosman, who was a well-known Musar figure. I, in my youth, not only in my youth, even into my 20s, there was a rabbi in my town of West Orange, New Jersey, named Herschel Cohen. Maybe some of you know who I'm talking about. He was a student, he told me, of Rabbi Chassman, Yehuda Leib Chassman. And if you look in Dov Katz's book on the Musar, I'm not Yehuda Leib, Aryeh Leib Kosman. You look on Dov Katz's book on the Musar movement, he deals with it. There was a great rav named Rabbi Yerucham Varhaftig. He was a Rav in Eretz Yisrael, Talmud Chacham. His son was Zorach Bar Haftig, very involved in Mizrahi politics. He wrote a number of Svarim. And in one of his Svarim, he has a long introduction in which he describes, he was a Telzer, in which he describes what happened in Telz and the dispute. And he describes Rabbi Chosman, first of all, as having a strong personality. That's usually a bad thing, I think, for a Musar teacher, because he's supposed to have more of a soft personality. But in any event, a strong personality, and Rabbi Varhaftig tells us that he rebuked the students for talking Torah, to use an expression, a Jewish expression, talking Torah during davening. That is, during davening, during Chazaras HaShatz, they'd be talking and learning. That's always been the big Yetzer Hara of the Yeshiva Bachrim. They talk and learning when they shouldn't be talking and learning. If that's their worst Yetzer Hara, I guess that's a good thing, but he said to them, he rebuked them and told them that Torah is when it's Torah study, it's Torah study, and when it's tefillah, and you shouldn't mix the two. Let me tell you something now you'll find interesting, I think. You know, we know that we're not allowed to talk during davening, but the question is, these students were talking and learning, and obviously there were some who were, when I say talking and learning, they're probably showing each other svarim, things like that, or chazaras hashatz. Well, can you learn during chazaras hashatz? If you look around, you see talmid hachamim, they do learn. It could be that they're not just sinning, maybe sinning in quotes. There's something very interesting in the Mishnah Berurah that, as far as I know, really hasn't been pointed out. So if you look in the Mishnah Berurah, in Or HaChaim, in Siman Kuf 124, Kuf Chaf Dalet, Sif Katan Yud Zayin, it says as follows. I don't know, this is dangerous, maybe, but I'm going to tell you now. You could use it. But it says that you shouldn't recite Tachanunim, I guess individual prayers of sorts, and you shouldn't learn during the time of the repetition of Shemona Esrei. That's what the Mishnah Berurah says. And even if you learn in the middle of it, but pay attention to the brachas at the end, because after all, the big thing is the brachas. So you could look in the learning and make sure you pick your head up to hear the brachas. Even that, he says, you shouldn't do that because you might miss the amen. You're not hearing, you can't just hear the amen without hearing the bracha. Then he says, and this is the important part to listen to, it's also not right. He doesn't say it's asur. He says, lo yafeh, it's not appropriate. It's not appropriate for the people that, for the lomdim, that is, for the scholars to do this. Why? Because if they do that, amei haaretz yilmodu mehen, shelo azin l'shatz, v'yasku b'sicha b'teilo, chas v'shalom, nintu machtina terabim. That is, then he says, right after saying you shouldn't do it, he says it's not appropriate, that no one's allowed to, no one can, learn during chazaras shatz. And then he has a second section where he says, and the Torah scholars, they have to be careful not to learn, because if they're learning, the Amei Aretz will see that they're not paying attention, and the Amei Aretz aren't going to learn. The Amei Aretz are going to talk, Sicha B'Teva, and therefore, the Lomdim, the Torah scholars, they're Machtim Es Arabim, because they are learning, and the Amei Aretz will see them, and the Amei Aretz will then also not pay attention and do Sicha B'Teva and miss the brachas and everything. And therefore, the Lomdim, the Torah scholars, caused the Amoratzim to sin. He's not saying that the Lomdim sin. He's saying that the Lomdim, through their actions, caused the Amei Aretz to sin. So the question, therefore, is, let's say it's a yeshiva minyan, and there's no Amei Aretz there. Can you, therefore, it seems to be a diuk from the Mishnah Berurah, that you should be able to look in, because as long as you can answer the amen, and you don't have to worry about the amei aretz. I actually had never known about this diuk, and I found it in a new sefer I just got. It's called Devar Chevron. It's Tshuvot. By Rav Dov Lior. The reason I ordered the book is because there's a number of Tshuvot from him to me in here, incidentally. Including one that has become quite famous in the religious Zionist world, dealing with kitniot. I didn't even know about this sefer, but I saw some writings that deal with kitniot and his permission on how to eat, like liquefied kitniot and things. And it was from a letter from me, so I got the book. And I'm no fan of his politics, so that's for sure. Rav Dov Lior, the Rav of Kiryat Arba, but he is a great, great Talmud Chacham. He is asked this question by one of the students, who says that, are you permitted to learn in the yeshiva during chazaras hashatz? Because there are people there who do pay attention. There's always 10 who pay attention. That is, there's 10 people who are paying attention. There's no question about that. And there are no Amei Aretz there. And Rabbi Lior replies to him, this is his words, Ein kedai lismoch ahadiyuk mehamishna berurah. He says, it's not appropriate to rely on this diuk of the Mishnah Berurah. And what's the reason? He acknowledges it's a good diuk. He says, because tamid yish makom sh'amei aretz yomdu mehem. He says, you're always going to find, there will always be a way that the Amoretz will learn from them. Because sometimes he goes on to say, sometimes people from the outside come in, who you don't know, and they're Amoretz. And then he says it's possible that they're actually, if everyone learns, there won't be 10 people paying attention. Therefore, he says, you shouldn't depart from the practice that even B'nai Torah can't learn during Chazaras HaShatz. But Rav Lior acknowledges that the Diyuk is a correct Diyuk. But he's saying, nevertheless, because you can't always tell, he says, sometimes people outside do, and you won't, and you can't be sure that there'll actually be 10. But if there's 10 people sitting and listening to the bracha, in theory, there's no problem. You don't have to pay attention to the Chazaras HaShatz. You can learn. But he concludes, never, that's only the halacha. But Lamaisa, he says you shouldn't. I had never seen that diuk in the Mishnah Berurah, which, as we would say, Pashtos, it's a correct diuk. Because the Mishnah Berurah makes, his whole point there is he says you're being machti at Arabim. Why does he say machti at Arabim? What does it matter that the Amoratzim are going to see you? If it's usher, it's usher for everyone. You don't need to make a special point that the Lomdim have to be careful that the Amoretz don't see them, precisely because the Mishnah Berurah knew that the Lomdim did look in. And if you go into any yeshiva, and if you go into any shul, what happens during Chazaras HaShatz? Plenty of Talmidei Chachamim are looking in Sfarim. So the good question is, you should ask these Talmidei Chachamim, what gives you the right to look in the Sefer? The Mishnah Berurah says you're not allowed to look in the Sefer. I don't know. Anyone, ask them and come back to me. I think the reason is that they're weak. People are weak. You know, they have a Yetzer Hara that they want to see what the Sefer says. And that's okay, you know. If that's the worst Yetzer Hara they have that they want to learn, they're in very good shape. I think I've already mentioned it. If I haven't mentioned, I'll deal with it in more detail when we deal with the Rugged Shover. The Rugged Shover used to learn in Avelos. When he was an Avel, the Rugged Shover learned. You're not allowed to learn as an Avel. It's Usser. And the Rugged Shover said, what can I do? I have a Yetzer Hara. I can't help it. The Torah, I need the Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik apparently, according to Roy Tenler, the same thing. He had to learn during his Avelos, during Shiva. So with, I don't know if you can, but anyway, Rabbi Chassman didn't hold of this. He saw people learning, talking and learning, whatever, during Chazaras HaShatz. He says, there's a time for learning. And there's a time for Torah study. So obviously this turned off some of the yeshiva students to him. He also made a rule that if a yeshiva student was absent from Musar Seder, he would be punished just like if he was absent from Gemara Seder. So what do I mean punished? We have to remember that we think of yeshivas today, we think of guys in their 20s basically on their own. No. You had some of them, but you also had guys, 14, 15, 16, 17, you know, teenagers, and you had a first time away from home, and you need to have rules. And and if you did miss Seder, there's all sorts of punishments, including they could ground you, but the big one was that they would reduce your stipend. These people received a little stipend from the yeshiva, or they would there was various punishments they can come up with. And he made a chidush here that if you miss Musar Seder, then it's as if you're missing Gemara Seder. And that was the problem of Rav Chassman. That Yisrael asked, do they force you to sign a loyalty oath? Yes, that alludes to what I said before. In the yeshivas in Israel today, you're forced to sign a loyalty oath. Well, no, you'll see they were more tolerant back then, but to an extent. We will see students kicked out of the yeshiva. But to be kicked out of TELS, you have to do a lot more than just say that you support, this Gadol, Rabbi Auerbach. In fact, it's interesting because usually among these people, they only, you know, in the Haredi world, if you support a more right-wing position, then it's okay. It's only if you're more liberal. So they would always go back after the Mizrahi. But today they're going after those on the right. But it's the old story. You fight among, you know, if you're going to fight and you're going to kill the outsider, then when you're done with him, you're going to turn on each other. If you can use language like Amalek and Korach and everything against the Dati Leumi population, and no one says anything and it's kosher because after all it's not your people, it's them, then when you have an internal fight among yourselves, well then you use this language against the other Haredi group. We've seen it over and over again throughout history, and we saw it in the early Hasidic movement, and we're seeing it now. So the problem with Rav Chassman, from the standpoint of the Yeshiva Bachrim, is that he saw no difference between Gemara and Musar. that they were of equal significance. And that was always the problem of the Musar people. In the Musar world, you had people who were good at Gemara, but then you had someone else who was good at Musar. And he was regarded as just as important by the real Musarniks. If someone was an expert in Musar, he was regarded as just as significant as someone who was great in Gemara learning. And that really undermines the traditional approach of Talmud study. Now, when Rabbi Chassman came in and made this decree, he also said, until then, the early students, that is the students in the first and second classes, the two lowest classes, they didn't have, you know, I shouldn't say that. Maybe it was the two highest classes. I'm not sure. It says Aleph and Beis. At first, I thought it was the two lower classes. But now I'm thinking it's probably the two higher classes. In any event, two of the classes, either the two lowest or the two highest, Shirim, I would now think it would be the two highest, had been exempted from Musar until now. Because I would think if you're going to exempt people from Musar until now, it wouldn't be the lower ones. It would probably be the ones who you think are the experts in Gemara learning. In any event, Rabbi Chassman declared, and he was given the authority by the administration, everyone has to come to Musar Seder. Now, this led to negative feelings. Now, it must be the first ones, because it was the big Lamdanim who turned against Rabbi Chassman, and they would have been in the top two classes, the first and second, that is the highest shiurim. They turned against Rabbi Chassman, and they went to the Rosh Yeshiva, and they organized the students with the complaint that the Mashkiach was weakening Torah study at the yeshiva because he's focusing on Musar. Remember, the Mashkiach himself is not a great Lamdan. They never were brought in to be great Lamdanim. They were Torah scholars, and they focused on Musar. But when I say a Lamdan, we're not talking about people who can give a shiur in the Ketzos HaChoshen, people who were Bucky and all of Shas and everything. We're talking about the Mashkiach, the one who focused on other areas. He would read Musar Svarim and things like that. Obviously, they knew Talmud, but the Mashkiach has a different role, as he should. The Mashkiach, Rabbi Chassman, had also begun inviting students, favorites of his, because there were students who liked Musar. He had begun inviting favorites to his house on Shabbos. And during those Shabbosim, he was teaching them Musar. And, putting his influence upon them, as a Mashkiach should do. However, his opponents, thought that this was the creation of a sect, a new sect in the yeshiva, and that it would separate the yeshiva because you'd have the Musar people loyal to Rabbi Chassman, and you'd have the others. And they went to the Rosh Yeshiva again, and actually in this matter, Rabbi Lazer Gordon put a stop to it. The Mashkiach was no longer permitted to bring students back to his house to create a fifth column. The same thing, incidentally, happened at Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. When we had the classes on Rav Avram Shapiro, I spoke about this, how Rav Avram Shapiro was the Rosh Yeshiva, and the equivalent of the Mashkiach was Rabbi Tau. He was really a holdover from the days of Ritzvi Yehuda. He wasn't a great Lamdan in the Talmudic sense, but he was a great Baal Machshava. And in the Merkaz world, they call it Emunah. They don't call it Machshava, Emunah. And he did not accept the authority of Rav Shapiro as the Rosh Yeshiva. What was he doing? He was giving them Hashkafa, Emunah, and becoming a leader in his own right, and that was creating a sect in the yeshiva. And that led to Rabbi Tau basically being forced out. He was forced out and opening his own yeshiva, Har Hamor. So it's the same thing. And all you need to have the Rosh Yeshiva in charge of everything, and especially during this dispute. Nevertheless, despite this step by Rabbi Gordon, Rabbi Lazer, to stop the students to go into his house, Rabbi Chassman still was running the show when it comes to Musar. He gave Musar Shmuzin, he insisted on coming to Musar, and in 1897, the students revolted. How did they revolt? They went on strike. An actual strike. According to one report, the strike was in response to a campaign, which the Mashkiach, that would be his job to be involved in, a campaign against those students who were reading Haskalah. You know, the Mashkiach would also make sure that you weren't reading Haskalah literature. The students simply stopped learning. And they said they're not going to start learning until their demands were met. I don't know of any other examples of a strike. we had a revolt prior to this in Volozhin Yeshiva when the Netziv wanted to put his son in, Rav Chaim Berlin. The students didn't feel he was a big enough lamdan, and they had a revolt. But an actual strike where you close the svarim and you say, we're not going to learn, I mean, that's not a yeshiva then. If the students are just sitting there and no one's opening a book and no one's learning, there's no sound of Torah, that's not learning. You know, about strike, let me just tell you, because I quoted today the autobiography of the Aderis. In the Aderis' autobiography, he talks about how he went on strike. He was a rabbi in a community, and a poor community, and they didn't pay his salary. You know, 1 month, 2 months, they stopped paying his salary. So he went on strike. He said he is no longer going to answer any more shilas. And you have to understand what it means to be in the traditional community in Lithuania. For him to say he's not going to answer shilas, that all of a sudden puts enormous pressure on the community, because we're not in my town, and you know, in a place where we live, if the rabbi said I'm not going to answer shilas, most people don't ask shilas. So, you know, if the rabbi doesn't want to hear my shilas, fine. Most people don't ask shilas. It's the rabbi always telling him what to do, and they'll be very happy. The rabbi's not going to tell me what to do, because into hay. But these are people, they need shilas. They need shilas every week. They have questions about chicken. They need to know if the chicken's kosher. They have other shilas. And if the rabbi says, I'm not going to answer your shilas, then he's holding all the strings. And that is what forced the community to start paying a salary, to find the money for the salary, because the community needed the rabbi more than the rabbi needed the community. Today, it's hard to imagine that. The rabbi needs the community more than the community. Community can go without a rabbi. Sometimes when they get a new rabbi, it can go a year or 2 years or more before they get a new rabbi. But in a small town in Lithuania, the community needed a rabbi. So the students went on strike. And let me read you from Stamfer's book. I'll read you a paragraph here that comes... This comes out of Rabbi Varhaftig. It's a very interesting sefer. It's called Minchas Yeruchim. He has a few of them, and in the introduction, he has a long description of the revolt that happened in Tells, including naming names. I'll tell you an important name soon enough. This volume, if you look in Beit Eket Sfarim, you'll see it was only printed one time. One printing in Jerusalem in the 1950s. However, there are two editions of it. The front page is the exact same. There's no indication. But in some of the volumes, it's the story of Tells is complete. In others, things are cut out. What must have happened was, during the printing, a number of volumes had already been printed, and he showed people, or people had read it, and people complained that he was revealing too much dirty laundry. So in the midst of the printing, before the run was done, they reset certain pages and then completed it. So today, it's actually a rare book, the one that has the complete printing on Otsar HaChachma, and I think it's on HebrewBooks.org as well. It's definitely on one of those two because I saw it. It has the censored volume, but it's not censored in the sense that someone else censored it. The Machaber himself took out the things. However, fortunately, stay right here. I got the safer right over here. This volume, Yeshivot Lita, Pirkei Zichronot, it's memoir literature of the Lithuanian yeshivas, edited by Emmanuel Etkes and Shlomo Tukashinsky, published in 2004. This has a section by Yerucham Asher Varhaftig, Merit HaMusar B'Yeshiva Tells, and it's just by luck, or Hashkacha Pratit, that they have the complete story of it. And the reason why I say that is because it was just luck. I know Shlomo Tukashinsky, I know Etkes also, they didn't realize that there were two versions. They took a sefer, one of the sefer that they had, that and this is also the one, by the way, that... Stamper has, and they took out that section and republished it. Had when they gone to the library, the copy in the library happened to be the one that was censored, they wouldn't have known. They would have taken that and they would have reprinted it. And so fortunately we have for all history now the actual version. The odds are they're both over at the Hebrew University, using the Hebrew University, since the first books that were printed have to be sent copies just like the Library of Congress to the Hebrew University. that's probably why the Hebrew University has the uncensored copy, and the later volumes, and by the way, I looked at a number of copies and it did not have. I have never seen an actual copy that's complete. I've only seen it quoted in Stamford and quoted in here, because the volume I saw at, was it Harvard Library, I believe, and I didn't look at the seminary, and the volumes that are online, they are the later printings, the censored one. Okay, I see it's already even after 10, so let me stop here, and when we pick up next week, I will take you into the great, the revolt and the strike, the great dispute at the Tel Yeshiva. So let me stop now, and I'll see if anyone has questions. I see Yisrael writing in. We'll take some questions. Yisrael says, the idea of making different levels of class, was this new to Eastern Europe or to all of Ashkenaz? The other yeshivas didn't have this. Tells, as far as I know, Tells adopted some very modern things. Tells itself is, there was a machina program to get into. In Tells, the Rosh Yeshiva believed in a newspaper, and you had all sorts of things like that. So they had different levels. They tried to divide students. I don't think there was any rule that you couldn't go in to hear the, the big shiur of the Rosh Yeshiva. It might have been a shiur klali, but they did divide, have different teachers for different, to give shiurim at different levels. In Germany, they had a seminary, so it was different. It wasn't a classical yeshiva. You studied with a teacher. But mostly yeshivas, you just come in and study, and then the Rosh Yeshiva will give a shiur, but until it was a little different. Since you asked that, I'll get you some details next class, but Stanford discusses all this. No, they didn't really. I mean, they had yeshivas in Germany really died out in the 19th century. And when Hirsch tried to open a yeshiva, when Hirsch never opened a yeshiva in Frankfurt. Hirsch's son-in-law tried to open it, and the community refused to participate. They said, if Hirsch didn't open a yeshiva, we're not going to open a yeshiva. Yeshiva's not for us. It's for Eastern Europe. His son-in-law had to raise the money himself. And then there was a yeshiva. But this was after Hirsch's death. And in there was a yeshiva earlier in the 19th century. Yaakov Ettlinger had a yeshiva when he was in Mannheim and then when he was in Altona. But by the mid-19th century, there weren't any yeshivas in Germany. And then you have the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. Yeshiva learning, we know that wasn't such an important thing in Germany. Yes, so that's why people like Rav Schwab, as Yisrael said, went to Eastern Europe. Although, when Rabbi Schwab went to Eastern Europe in the 1920s, he could have gone to the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, which is not a classical yeshiva, but sort of. And there was already yeshivas in Frankfurt. There was a yeshiva from the Hirschian community, and there was a yeshiva from the non-Hirschian community. That is the what they call the Gemeinde. They had a yeshiva as well. However, Rabbi Schwab, like many others, wanted to go to one of the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe, namely the Lithuanian yeshivas. There were many Jews in Germany who did not go to Lithuanian yeshivas. Instead, they went to Pressburg because they were, that was thought to be, it was a German-speaking area, Pressburg, and it was very close to Vienna. So, for example, Professor Alexander Altman, who I knew, who was from Germany, when he went to yeshiva, before he went to the seminary, he went to Pressburg. And Yaakov Katz, not that he came from Germany, he went to Pressburg, though, and from there he went to Frankfurt. He went to the yeshiva in Frankfurt. He talks in his autobiography, he had to decide which yeshiva to go to, because both yeshivas in Frankfurt were Hungarian yeshivas. Breuer is a Hungarian, and the other yeshiva, Yaakov Hoffman's yeshiva, was also a Hungarian yeshiva. And so you had yeshivas then. Okay, I see Yisrael is sending on another question, so I'll wait for that. Yisrael says, I heard the strike was over lack of food. Not true. No, the strike was not over lack of food. But we'll talk more about the strike next week. That's what I'm going to pick up on. It wasn't over lack of food. Or I should say that that's not how it's reported by Varhoftig and the others who talk about it. Maybe there is a source that mentions lack of food, but that is not in any of the sources that Stanford quotes. Yisrael asks, and I repeat the questions for people who listen. We have many more people who listen by tape. I was in Flatbush over Shabbos, and it's always a pleasure. I'm very happy. People I've never met, who never emailed me, never heard of them, they came up to me and told me that they listened to the tapes, and so that's a big thrill. So I have to repeat the question. Yisrael asks, is the fighting of late between the Haredi world's biggest scholars or just the noisiest? I think it's both. First of all, I don't know when you've ever had a situation where in the Litvisha world, one great rabbi, one gadol, says about another gadol in the Lithuanian world that he's illegitimate, that he's korach, that his students are puzzle for being edim, that you can't count them, you have to throw them out of your kolel, basically, michutz l'machaneh. And if it was just Yateid Ne'eman or the newspapers saying that, well, who cares? They always are interested in fomenting hatred. These are two great rabbis, three great rabbis, if you count Rabbi Steinman, who really hasn't said anything, but it's Yav Rav Chaim Kanievsky and Yav Shmuel Auerbach, who in the Haredi world, in our world, I'm speaking of the more modern world, these are not people who we go to, really, but they are enormous scholars with influence. Rav Chaim Kanievsky has more influence than Shmuel Auerbach, but Shmuel Auerbach has also influence, you know, the idea that he's not entitled to have his own newspaper, he's not entitled to have his own path, well, why not? If he's a great Torah sage, why does he have to fall in line? Does Rav Avad Yosef also have to fall in line? Does everyone have to fall in line? Apparently so, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky thinks that Rav Yehuda Steinman is the divinely ordained, it's like the imam in Shia Islam. A friend of mine who's in this world, very much in this world, said to me that he suspects, he can't prove it obviously, but he suspects that Rav Chaim Kanievsky might be going senile. Because his entire life, Rav Chaim Kanievsky has counseled thousands of people, people go to him day and night, he has never spoken like this before in history. He's never come out publicly and said things like this. And now all of a sudden, everyone who comes in to speak to him, they come with a tape recorder and he is saying the most outrageous things, the most offensive things. And here is someone his entire life has never said things like that, has always, you know, been quiet and not interested in getting involved in machlokas at all, ever. So what does it mean when someone in their 80s, mid-80s, I think he's 86, when he's saying all these crazy things and my friend suspects that, you know, he's at a stage of his life where he's able to be manipulated. People come in, they can ask him things, and he says, I mean, how can a man speak about hanging them, even if it's you say it's a joke, you know? And quote the pasuk, "Tolo tamara eitz." How can you say that he's high, that these people are high of skila because they don't listen to the Gadol Hador? I mean, this is unbelievable stuff. You've had in the Hasidic world, in the early Hasidic world, statements like that. Unless you assume, like my friend says, that Chaim Kanievsky, he's not really. You know, old, when people get old, they start saying things and they don't control always what they should be saying. Isn't that what we just said about Norman Lamb? He accomplished so much in his life, and someone gets in to have an interview with him without going through the proper channels, and he gets Rabbi Lamb to say all sorts of things, and now Rabbi Lamb is shown that he's not even able to be deposed because he doesn't have the mental capacity. When people are not mentally 100% there, they could be there 90%, but it's not fair to speak to them, and it's not fair to quote them. And that's why the court will not allow Rabbi Lamb to be deposed. If Rav Chaim Kanievsky is still a gadol who knows all of Shas, you know, by heart, but it could be that in one aspect of him, doesn't think before he says things. I don't know. Other than that, you have to explain how a great Torah sage is speaking about people who worthy of being killed. I mean, it's and that they have to be thrown out of the kolel, and they have to sign loyalty oaths, and that they're korach, and I don't know how else to explain it. Yisrael says, how are the Haredim taking all this? Are they buying into it, or are they uncomfortable? I spoke to a friend of mine, I have a very insightful friend. He sometimes listens to these classes in Lakewood, and I spoke to him 2 days ago, I think it was, or 3 days ago. He told me that the Americans in Lakewood don't take any of this seriously. They never have taken it seriously. They're not into all the politics. The idea that someone will say to them, you have to vote for this party or that party, they don't care. And I think that's maybe their American training. He also said to me that they don't hold of Rav Chaim Kanievsky like this, you know, that they don't think of him as a manhig, as a leader. They think of him as a great Torah scholar, but not as a leader. So that's what he said. But in Israel, they take it very differently. The head, the entire community is led by Rabbi Steinman and Rav Chaim Kanievsky. And the Israeli government has said that any kollel that throws someone out because of their political view will not receive money from the Israeli government. Let's see whether the Israeli government actually follows through on that, because Rabbi Steinman, when asked about this, said it doesn't matter. You have to throw them out anyway. We don't need their money. It's a very sad time for the Haredi world, I think. Maybe it's the beginning of the breakdown of this world, because Rabbi Shmuel Auerbach is not folding. So you got to give him credit. Like I said, I give him a lot of credit. He has not responded in kind. Some of his people have. Rav Chaim Kanievsky's books were burnt in B'nai Brak. Who burnt them? It's probably just one crazy man, but their books of his were burnt. But Rav Shmuel Auerbach has not responded. All he said was that, because people were worried, Rav Chaim Kanievsky is like a holy man. They go to him for brachos. And when he made his statements, his curses, Rabbi Auerbach said, you do not have to worry. The curses are on me. What happened is, according to one of the reports, that men, certain men came to Rabbi Auerbach and said their wives are afraid to vote for his party, the B'nai Torah party, because of Chaim Kanievsky's curse. And Rabbi Auerbach said to them, you can vote for it and not to worry. The curse will go on me. And he didn't curse Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky or his people back. The real question, as I mentioned already, is though why Rav Shmuel Auerbach wants to be the mamshich of Rav Shach. Why can't he be the mamshich of his father? So I asked my friend from Lakewood that, and he said the answer is obvious. Because as far as he's concerned, his father's a Mizrachinik. His father's a follower of Rav Kook. His father's not kosher enough for him. That's the problem, that Rav Shlomo Zalman is too liberal. Okay, we'll say goodnight for now. Yisrael, let me just... Yisrael, one more thing. Okay, last question, and we'll hold on. The rest, if you want to email it to me, Yisrael, I'll talk about it in this class. Yisrael says, Rabbi Soloveitcher seems to get the worst treatment by the Haredi. Might that be because he was the most influential, so he's viewed as the biggest threat? Yeah, that's always the case. That's always the case. Saturday night, though, in Flatbush, after my talk, two Hasidim came up to me, and they said that actually, forget about the Litvish, but in the Hasidic world, Rav Kook is now becoming somewhat popular. That in the Sorim stores, they're selling his books, and the Hasidim are reading them. So his argument was that the Hasidic world is becoming more open-minded. Not only that, he said the Litvish world is taking the worst aspects of the Hasidic world. And those who are listening now, who are at the talk Saturday night, it was the two guys with the long bekeshas who came up to me afterwards. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. I look forward to continuing... same time next week. Good night, everyone.